We're live.
Going on?
John, Alan, how are you guys today?
Oh, good. Good, good.
Yeah, it's good. Out here in sunny Denver, Colorado.
Denver, Colorado.
90 degrees today. Pretty nice.
Oof. So I've
Not
got a
calling
question.
from
I saw
Orlando.
you're winning out of the three of us. Orlando's the much better location. Are you gonna go? Isn't Disney World there?
Yeah, you know, I was
Disneyland?
trying to like, you know, I was trying to lure the family to go to Disneyland, but my wife is over it. We went to the one in Paris, and it wasn't that great. So,
It wasn't that. Why wasn't it that great? What's the difference between like Disneyland in Paris and Disneyland here?
oh man, I don't know. You know, just having a newborn is tough. So,
Think you also lost your wallet that week, Alan.
yeah, what an adventure! But that's a longer story for a different time, I guess.
Yeah, different time. And John, I got a question. I saw a. Oh, by the way, cheers, boys.
Cheers.
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 Cheers. Cheers. I hope no one at ECC looks at my work calendar because it's obviously got like what time we're doing this at. Like, I'll post this probably next week, but if they see like I was drinking this early in the afternoon, don't think they'd be happy. But alas, we are here. John, so in Denver, I saw someone tweet recently that you can start vaping shrooms. When do you think shrooms are going to be legalized in Denver?
Can't speak to that. I've just seen some of those DMT cartridges at music festivals, but
No.
I don't partake. They
DMT cartridges?
put them in those little, I don't know what it is, little
So
cartridges.
isn't that the thing, like you go to Peru and you take it and you can't talk for like 48 hours and it's like it takes you to
That's
another world?
mescaline or peyote or something, but
Ugh.
yeah, I think based on the reaction of my buddy who was there at the festival, I would say, yeah, he was definitely in another universe. So I can't speak. I do know medicinal, well, psilocybin mushrooms are decriminalized in Denver specifically.
Oh, so you can take so you if you got shrooms and like, well, you can't take them, you can't transport them over state. That's the weirdest part. So if someone was selling shrooms or growing them and you got them, you can't get busted for that.
I think you can get busted. They just, the DA can't criminalize it, so they can't charge you with anything. So you might pay a fine or something, but you can't go on your record. I don't really know.
And they
That's not
take
from
it
my
away.
I just know it's decriminalized here. And so yeah, there's a good amount of mushrooms at Red Rock shows and stuff like that. So
All right. I want to get the. I've never done it before. I want to get the vaping cartridges. I saw someone tweet that, and I want to do that. Out of all the things like I want to do in my life, that is probably, I'd say, like 13th on the list.
it's not
Well,
even in the top 10.
I'm 13.
Well-ordered catalog list.
On the list I just made up right now. Okay. All right, guys. Welcome to what an intro. Welcome to the podcast. This is the third episode here, and brought you guys on to talk about Railgun and private Pry-Fi. But before we dive into all that, like, just give you both a chance to introduce yourself to people who may not know who you are and what you guys are currently working on.
Yeah, John, why don't you go first?
Okay, sounds good. Yeah. My name's John, the real JMJ in Telegram and Twitter. I head up the product side for the Railgun project team in the DAO, as well as help to organize a lot of the engineering efforts that we do, both internally and with collaborative teams externally.
And yeah, I'm Alan. I guess on like Twitter, Telegram, and Discord, I am alter egoed as Railalu-ya churchgoer, the resident DAO janitor. I focus more on everything that isn't development. So that is, you know, everything from you know, writing articles, taking and coordinating our community, you know, helping develop website marketing materials. Yeah, everything that's not coding in order to, you know, basically pave the way for these guys to be able to focus on coding and not like the menial tasks. So, you know, we call this like, you know, janitorial work. It's always busy. There's a lot of it, and it's frequently underappreciated, but I'm excited to be here doing it.
At other companies, they refer to janitors as the chief strategy officer. So I think you you have the best title, I think, in the, you know, in the crypto universe. I feel it's very underappreciated. I think more people need to know about the title of janitor.
Yeah, you need to own it. Exactly. Janitor is the way.
Awesome. Well, cool. Thank you. Thanks for that, guys. And I know you guys, we're friends. We've hung out before. I know about Railgun. For people who don't know about Railgun, could you just provide, I guess, like a 30-second to a minute primer before we dive into this conversation about private decentralized finance?
Oh, man. I guess I'll give a stab at that. So Railgun is a privacy infrastructure system that's been developed for the DeFi ecosystem. And so what it allows people to do is take the SDK, the developer kit, and integrate privacy into the applications that they are developing. And you could see this in work today on the Railway app. There's a team who developed a wallet application called Railway, and this has the Railgun SDK littered all through it. So you can actually take and hold tokens privately. And this is like any ERC token that you would like. And you can transact those, so send them to other people, and they have the first Lighthouse case of the DApp integration, so you can actually take and swap tokens in a private and anonymous way. I guess anything you'd add to that, John?
Yeah, I would say, I think one of the reasons we're definitely all Zcash bulls, the way that Railgun actually operates is it's sort of taking the encryption layers developed by Zcash and sort of the cryptography, the SNARKs, ZK SNARKs cryptography, and wrapping it into a Solidity smart contract that can run on Ethereum, that can run on Polygon, that can run on Binance Smart Chain, and soon Solana, Polkadot, Near, some other chains. So it's applicable across all these different interfaces and all these different layers on various blockchains. And it is fully end-to-end encrypted and private. So along the same lines as Zcash, of course, its own chain, but, applied to other existing chains.
Okay. And we're going to dive into that. So we're gonna break down like the technical aspect. I've got a laundry list of questions today. I feel like this is an interview. Like I've got a laundry list of questions. But I want to break that down, but I want to roll it all back because I feel like this isn't maybe applicable to the Zcash community because I think most Zcashers or people who are like, heavy into the ecosystem probably have some experience. While it might be limited, they have some experience with decentralized finance. But for people, for my mom, when I sent her this podcast after it's recorded, could you explain to everyone at a 10th grade level what is decentralized finance?
John, what do you think? You want to give a go at that one?
Sure, I will. So rather than having a centralized like banking authority where, for example, you might have a savings account dictated by that bank, it has an account number, it has a routing number if you want to write checks, right? Rather than having an account that's stored in their system, for example, you couldn't go between Chase and another bank, right? US Bank, and share the same account, right? It's centralized to either Chase or US Bank or one of your local banks. They maintain essentially a registry of all the transactions that you've done, your entire bank statement, and what your balance is. And they'll okay or they'll reject certain payments depending on certain factors, right? There are some troubling aspects with having centralized banking. And I won't necessarily get into those, but there are a lot of troubling aspects with those. And so just what blockchains have done is sort of decentralize, rather than having a central entity that holds the power and authority to tell you when or when you can't transact. There is a million computers around the world that don't really have a way to block transactions, but they facilitate them. And so rather than having a central authority that you need to pass your transactions through with your Visa debit card or whatever, it actually goes to somebody's computer around the world in a trustless manner and it essentially enables you to use your money in a way that can't be censored can't be rejected, you know, as long as you have the finances. So on top of that layer, right, you can build a lot of financial applications, including, you know, taking out loans whatever reason, you know, essentially using margin accounts to get leverage on certain asset buys or sells, trading different assets similar to a stock exchange. All of these are sort of DeFi, decentralized finance applications that are built in like on top of the blockchain layer. So you inherit all the trustlessness, you inherit the security, and in some ways the pseudonymity, the privacy of having, you know, essentially not having your name represented on that account. Yeah. You inherit some of these aspects and can build pretty sophisticated financial applications on top. And the other piece that's interesting about it is that each of these financial applications are completely public. They're written in essentially what's called smart contracts. So they're written in a coding language. They're open sourced. They're essentially posted online. And you can get access to any of these tools just by having access to the internet, which is a really kind of novel approach to doing a lot of these things.
And let's dive into that aspect really quickly, just like a little sidebar here. So open sourcing, for people who don't know what that is, like open sourcing is essentially you have a code base where you've built an application. And when you open source the code, you're making it available for anybody to review, look at, and potentially suggest changes.
Yeah, and to contribute to. And so you'll see actually a lot of large companies, big tech companies, let's say Google, Facebook, Apple in part, Microsoft certainly, and Amazon have open sourced a lot of tooling that they've built internally, and they get a few benefits to that. It seems like a kind of a strange thing to do for a big company, right? You would think if they put a lot of research and effort into building a new technology, they might want to keep it under closed doors so they could just keep it to themselves. But in open sourcing a technology like Golang for Google or React for Facebook, those are new coding frameworks, new coding languages. In open sourcing them, they give access to a lot more people, essentially for free, and they extend the community that can upkeep these projects because they need constant work to keep them updated, to keep them fresh, to keep them essentially above the competition. And you know, in that way, someone like Google can have benefits from essentially free modifications, free work that the community is doing to help the Golang, like Go language. And so Google gets benefits out of that and the community gets benefits as well. It's sort of a mutual relationship. And so open sourcing is I think of all industries, I think cryptocurrency has taken open sourcing to like the next level.
Yeah,
because most everything is free and out there, especially we're dealing with financial technologies. People want to make sure that they're used by a lot of people, that they're very secure, that they inherit the benefits of having this community driven sort of coding practices.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that the one thing I'll add to that is that open sourcing code is good for a couple of reasons. From a non-technical person like myself, I can actually go and verify whenever I'm dealing with money, right, which is what ultimately you're doing in DeFi. I want to be able to go and check that whenever I interact with a contract that it's going to do the things that I intend it to do. So, for example, if I want to, you know, swap tokens for a different set of token, whatever that may be, you know, initiate some sort of buying and selling, I can actually go and reference the open source code associated with like the centralized exchange that I'm, you know, doing this with. And I think that's really, really a good thing to do, right? So we can actually take and, you know, really kind of lower those like trust assumptions that we make whenever interacting with these code bases if they're open source. And then I think too, you know, one of the core tenets that I'm sure all three of us will agree with in regards to, you know, more broadly crypto is the importance of like censorship resistance. And one of the key things that open sourcing code does in a censorship resistance kind of mindset is it allows that code to live on and be a lot more resilient against people who would perhaps rather not want it to be alive and well, if you will. So I think that that's probably one of the most important reasons that people open source their code for, you know, not only development speed and this kind of thing, like John had talked about, but, you know, perhaps more to the censorship resistance.
Okay, so back, so what I'm understanding right now is that you have this code base that's open sourced and it aids to censorship resistance. So you have the system where you can transact financially, you can do all these different things with financial assets and money. It's open source, it's censorship resistant, and the applications that are built on top of these systems, these financial applications, allow you to do things that anyone could do in a traditional financial market. You can take out a loan, you can trade assets, you can lend money, you can earn interest on your savings, and then all of that combined essentially just is another rendition of the traditional financial system. There's a lot of other stuff, but we're basically trying to recreate the traditional financial system on a new system that doesn't have an intermediary. Is that like the high level simple definition of decentralized finance?
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty fair assessment, you know, and from like a pragmatic standpoint, you know, I live in a country where it's, you know, pretty easy to get access to, you know, banking, right? I can very easily get a loan on a house. I can, you know, choose to lease a car or finance the car, or I could even do a balloon. I have access to like complicated derivatives and, you know, TD Ameritrade and all these different things. And I can buy and sell stocks and all of this stuff, right, based on like traditional markets. But, you know, we live in a very large world, right? And there's perhaps some people in the world that, you know, in crypto slang, we call them, you know, unbanked or the unbankable, right? These people don't have access to the traditional finance system. And this could be, you know, for a whole myriad of reasons, perhaps they don't have the ability to get KYC'd by a bank like Barclays or something like this. And so, you know, we, you know, are effectively enabling these people who in a, you know, in the current regime wouldn't have access to the financial, you know, things that we're included in, and we can kind of, you know, bring them along and, you know, give them access to the ability to have these things in a permissionless and decentralized manner.
So all of this sounds like if you kind of go down this, like this myriad of thinking of like, okay, there's this system where not everyone has access. It's not very fair. So there's this new system where everyone can kind of fact check it and it gives access to everybody. This sounds like a perfect world. What are the downsides? So is there a downside to using decentralized finance on a censorship resistant blockchain?
Well, I think the downsides are really when you start asking more questions about it, right? We know we've talked about what DeFi is, but when you start talking about, like, I guess the when question or the who, right? It's really novel. It's very new, right? I mean, probably the biggest decentralized exchange, Uniswap, right, launched only 3 or 4 years ago, and that, you know, you see now so many billions of dollars moving through Uniswap on a weekly basis. So these things are moving very quickly and growing very, 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 like extremely fast. But when you get any new technology, right, when you get any new like scheme, especially technological scheme, you get, you know, security risks and flaws, right? And so we've seen a variety of these bridges typically be between different blockchains that are used as sort of, imagine like a wire transfer between a couple banks. But in the blockchain world, we've seen a lot of hacks along these kind of seams between these new things that are all trying to integrate together, and a lot of loss of funds. And so this novelty, the fact that things are so nascent in this industry means that there's a lot of people getting taken advantage of because there's not a lot of understanding of the sort of the depth and complexity of these systems. And so it can be a little bit dangerous. And so there are certainly ways that people need to protect themselves, especially in these early days, you know, could make using DeFi applications a little more secure for ordinary folks.
Yeah. So I'll kind of touch on that as well. I think, you know, we kind of came out of like the old school, like, well, you know, world of like web development. You know, Facebook coined this like phrase. What was it? It was like move fast and break things, right? Or is it build fast and break things? Something along this line, right? And this really took over like Silicon Valley, and so people were really, you know, focused on, you know, building, shipping lots of code, and like getting an MVP out there quickly, right? And the reality is like while there are security vulnerabilities to doing things like this, or like, you know, perhaps less than desirable results, like a social media platform not just, you know, performing as you would like it, this same kind of like moniker has kind of weaseled its way into like financial applications development and crypto. And so you have these guys trying to work really fast and ship code and like beat the next guy. And, you know, while it's really important to try to, you know, develop some sort of first mover's advantage, you have to really strike a balance in between that and security. And we find that it's been really difficult for builders to do that. You know, we're dealing with money here at the end of the day, right? So we have to be very, very careful. And so, you know, one of the things that we really consider over, you know, just in our neck of the woods, whenever we're talking about Railgun, is that, you know, we actually kind of do the opposite and, you know, are sometimes, you know, criticized by the community for this, right? We move slow and try not to break things, right? You know, so we do the literally exact opposite. You know, we want to, you know, measure a million times and then cut once. But then I think too, you know, outside of security, I think one of the things that's really quite difficult is like understanding it. Like the barrier for entry is incredibly high, right? And this comes from like perhaps a user experience standpoint. But I can imagine, you know, and you said earlier, you're talking about like explaining crypto to your mom. And I think one of the challenging things that would be really, I can't imagine trying to explain Uniswap to my mom. Like, can you imagine, you guys, think about this for a second. So instead of, you know, you can go, great news, mom, instead of taking and, you know, depositing money into your bank, right, you can actually take and deposit it on Uniswap to get yield. And it's much higher than your bank would ever give you. Here's what you do. You take half your money and you swap it into something else. And, you know, they go, well, what's the other thing? And it's like, I don't know, whatever you want. And then you take and you provide that liquidity to the exchange at a certain range of numbers, and then you're going to get yield on it. It's going to be amazing. And you'll only get that yield if somebody isn't scanning the mempool and like snipering the yield out from under you. And it's incredibly difficult for people to understand, you know, and I just, you know, it's kind of laughable as like, you know, air quotes insiders to us, you know, but like we have a long way to go for like user experience. I think we're probably, you know, if crypto has anything to say about it, months away, but I think we're years away from like taking like what we have currently in the infrastructure and pushing that down into the substrate, into the plumbing of the ecosystem where people don't actually feel and witness this firsthand. And I think that that point, it'll be a lot more, you know, at least kind of ossified, resilient, less hacks, all of those things. But like, yeah, we're definitely out west, if you will, in the wild west, in the new world.
Yeah, I'd 100% agree with that. I think even from just like a traditional like a peer-to-peer like sending of money with cryptocurrency, I even think that user experience is very far off from what people are used to. It's like especially here in the west, like if you told it to someone in a different part of the world, they would be like, oh, I'm not relying on a central authority that might crash and lose all my money to like send money to my family and friends. That makes a ton of sense. But here in the West, it's like no one's experienced bank runs for the most part. No one's really lost their money if they put it into a relatively established financial institution. So most people just don't understand that. So I think the UX and the understanding of why this is important. Yeah, I would agree a few years off. But I want to pivot as well here. So John, you mentioned within this realm of DeFi, you mentioned pseudonymity. So using a pseudonym and not having your name attached to your address that you're running these transactions with, this wallet per se. How have people using DeFi to gain financial privacy over the last 5 years with pseudonymous addresses? And is that effective?
There's a variety of ways that people have tried to create financial privacy in DeFi.
Keyword tried.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of the day, right, when you create a Zcash wallet or you create an Ethereum wallet and load money into it, you're given an address. On Ethereum, it starts with 0x and then a bunch of numbers and letters. And essentially that address is permanent. It will never change for that account. It is essentially the account ID. And you can send money from that address and you can send money to that address. And that's sort of how the balance goes up or down. That address by itself has no relation to your own identity, right? It doesn't have your social security number encoded in it. It doesn't have your name, you know, listed or your email. There's no real way to tie it to you unless you were to tie it to yourself, right? If, for example, Ian, you were to send me $50 today, right? I have your address now because I can see who I was sent money from, you know? It's a 99.99% chance if you told me you're sending $50 that you're the address that sent me $50, right? And using that address, I can actually look up your entire financial history. I can look at everything you're holding. So imagine everything in your stock market account, but the crypto variant. I can look up every transaction you've ever done. So you sent me $50. Well, who did you send $100 to last week, right? I can see everything you've ever done because it's imprinted, it's encoded into the public ledger that is Ethereum. And so once that tie is made, right? If I know that an address is yours, Ian, it will never change, right? The ownership doesn't change. Of course, you could pass that account on. I'm not sure the relevance of that to this conversation, but I always know your address and all the inputs and outputs. So you could try to change addresses and send your assets to another one, but I could trace that as well, right? Because I know your initial address. And so right now, the way that most funds and individuals sort of create privacy by themselves is they'll take their wallet A, for example, right? They'll generate wallet B. And rather than send money directly to wallet B to like start it up, to seed that wallet with money to do DeFi, DeGen stuff, they'll actually use a centralized exchange. So they'll use essentially a shared account amongst all Coinbase users. They probably have 8 or 10, wallets that have hundreds of thousands of transactions on a monthly basis between all these wallets. So in all that noise, you become a little harder to track, right? So yeah. If I were to send, let's say I have 5 ETH, for example, and I want to get it from wallet A to wallet B, I can send it first to Coinbase, okay? And then I can withdraw it into wallet B, and it will be really hard to trace that because there's so many ins and outs from Coinbase itself. The difficulty, though, with that model, and that's what a lot of people use, There's two things. One is that Coinbase charges fees and the ins and outs of the money you're transferring. Okay, small fees, but it's not.
It's not dollars.
So small fees on the transfers. You also have to have an account with Coinbase, and they do KYC. So if you're transferring large amounts of money, you're going to have to register with them as a U.S. entity. They're going to know. They're going to take down your social and whatever else like a normal bank does. So that's something that, you know, a lot of folks that are more into decentralization and less into the central banks don't necessarily want to do. But again, this is one of the only ways to actually establish some kind of privacy in these DeFi systems today. Yeah, in order to not be traceable, most people use a centralized exchange.
Yeah, in terms of like privacy and crypto, like that's on like public ledgers, like people do a lot of things. Like centralized exchanges is one of them, right? Outside of the fees and like somebody actually knowing who you are, right? For sure, at least one entity can track you, and that is, you know, Coinbase or whomever it is that you're doing business with. But you also have like, you know, central authority risk. Very famous, mantra of crypto is, you know, not your keys, not your crypto, right? And, you know, effectively what you're doing whenever you take and you transfer your funds into a centralized exchange is you're effectively handing over the keys to your crypto, right? And this can be all your money in the world, right? And if history tells us anything, is that it frequently repeats itself, and, you know, it started with, you know, Mt. Gox got hacked, but you also have like, you know, crypto.com, you got Bitmart, Liquid, KuCoin, Binance, Bitthumb, Bitfinex, the list goes on, right? All of these, you know, centralized exchanges got hacked and lost people's money. They lost their money. And that's really bad. I can't imagine if like all my life savings, I was just trying to be private and, you know, keep myself from being doxxed, if, you know, using a centralized exchange to do this, you know, I had my funds lost. But then there's also something, if you think about it from a more like, you know, pedantic level, if you have a position on, right, and you take and you transfer it in some places, not tax advice here, but we'll consider to be, you know, a taxable event, you know, or maybe you're providing liquidity, like you somehow magically explained it to your mom how to do Uniswap and she's providing liquidity, wants to get privacy, she has to collapse that position, move it into a centralized exchange, and then, you know, reset it up if she wants to continue getting that yield. So there's a lot of like, just cumbersome work involved with that. And, you know, it gets, you know, really interesting when you get to like the institutional level, because they'll start to run, you know, even hundreds of wallets in like a, you know, a robotic way, if you will, to like build positions and try to be anonymous. But frankly, most of this stuff is a stopgap to, you know, to privacy. It's kind of, I think the easiest way would be to, I don't know, take in RenBridge over into Zcash and use it to be private if that's what you wanted to do. But it's really quite difficult to have that in DeFi in today's world, I think.
And there's security risks with that as well, right? Like if you're trying to, let's say, shield your Ethereum for, let's say, a month, right? Let's say a month. You take your Ethereum, you move it over via RenBridge to Zcash into a Zcash shielded wallet. There's a variety of different security risks there. One, is the value of Zcash going to correlate exactly with the value of Ethereum? So are you going to lose or gain Ethereum? That's a risk that you have to take. And then also, it's if you're transferring in $1,000 and then 3 months later or a month later, you transfer out $1,000, all of these chain surveillance companies are able to track that and very easily decipher who is transferring $1,000 in and out of the RenBridge via Zcash. So like,
yeah.
I said this last night. I was like, if you're going to use Ren, move Zcash into a wallet and don't touch it, or move Zcash to Ethereum and then never move it back. Right? Like it's one, you can't kind of like mix the transactions because
yeah,
if you do that over the course of a longer period of time, unless you have really good operational security, like I guess skills, you're putting
right.
Big risk of doxing yourself with all if you're doing the transactions quite frequently. So
yeah,
I think that's a risk, right? So you can maybe try to do that for like more privacy in DeFi. But let's bridge this all into the solution that you guys are working on to kind of solve this problem of the financial privacy within DeFi, and it's called Railgun. Let's just talk about the origin story and kind of what is Railgun.
Yeah, so Railgun was originally ideated in a white paper in late 2020. And effectively what this white paper outlined was that you could take like new cryptography standards and some of the EIPs, the Ethereum Improvement, I guess, are they proposals? I can't remember what the P stands for. Anyway, suffice it to say, you could take like these different primitives and put them together to finally build a truly on-chain privacy solution. And what I mean by on-chain is that you don't have to compromise and use some sort of like centralized service or like some sort of like external like bridging mechanism or like a different chain or something like that. You could do it all with smart contract logic on-chain. And so in early 21, a team got together, basically spun up what is known as the Railgun project. And you can see those people on the website. John and I are... you know, two of the people who joined, not necessarily right at the beginning, but very short thereafter. But right at the beginning, there was a lot of ideation on how this could come together. So everyone was, you know, Hisham, Kai, and a few other folks, you know, took and got together and, you know, basically started hashing out, if you will, no pun intended, how to take and build a privacy solution on chain using cryptography, came down to the solution that we have today, which is the current smart contract system that's deployed. And so Railgun originally had a beta that got deployed last summer, and then a V1 contract which was deployed I guess just shy of 90 days ago or something like that. and it's currently being used. Well, it's hard to tell because it's pretty private, but we've seen several million dollars worth of transaction volume flowing through it. And, you know, basically what it does is it allows people to maintain a private balance of tokens, very similar to how Zcash does it. You can have a public balance and you can have a private balance. And then with that private balance, you can take and do the DeFi things that you're used to doing, but do it with your private zero ZK address. And we kind of, you know, min-maxed for, you know, three basic things when building it. That is, you know, security, gas optimizations, and then like cross contract calls is what they're called. So like being able to do like true DeFi interactions without any like overt complexities that would be associated with doing that. And yeah, I guess, you know, John, do you have anything you'd want to add to maybe segue into something else?
Cool. Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, you know, as we stated earlier, it's sort of, it's very similar to like Zcash in sort of the nature of the protocol, but wrapped into a usable interface on Ethereum. And so you can get, you know, Ethereum, I think, has now north of $20 billion moving in and out of different DeFi protocols on a literally a daily basis. That's between $20 and $30 billion, which, of course, is a lot of money. And it's all moving between all these public addresses. So it's traceable. There are literally companies, you know, Nansen, Chainlytics, that have built business models around tracing all of these transactions and understanding them. Well, in financial markets, typically, you don't have a lot of traceability, right? We can't look under the hood of what some of the big banks are doing, or some of the VCs or hedge funds like are doing with their money. They put a lot of money into the research behind a lot of these decisions, and therefore they don't want them shared publicly when they go to make certain buys or sells or shorts or whatever. So in the same way, our thesis is that the DeFi markets will require a similar vein of privacy, like throughout everything that they're putting money into and out of. And that Railgun is a way that they could systematically introduce privacy into their current sort of lines of business.
Okay. And so with that, there are other privacy solutions that are coming to market. So a couple I can think of off the top of my head. I know Aztec is somebody within Ethereum that's building, I don't know if something similar, but I think they're doing it at the layer two level. I think ZK Sync, which is a ZK rollup to Ethereum, is thinking has privacy on their roadmap after they solve for scalability. I think a couple other of the ZK rollups have that in their roadmap as well, but I'm not sure right now. What's the value prop for Railgun? And again, we're talking specifically to Ethereum right now, but correct me if I'm wrong. I think you mentioned this earlier. It's on Polygon, Ethereum, Binance Smart Chain, and potentially Solana. I think I'm missing one as well. Is there one
later,
more?
Solana, Near, and Polkadot.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's the value prop versus these other solutions that are currently coming to market?
Yeah, well, I do want to mention, and I think this is pretty common philosophy in the Zcash community, is that privacy, if not built into the core as a central, like version one utility of your smart contract or blockchain or DApp application, if it's not built into the core, it's really hard to add on later. And so, you know, not to doubt what others are doing with their, you know, L2 solutions, putting privacy on their roadmap, it's going to be really kind of a difficult change. Mm-hmm. But when we look at one like Aztec, which is an L2, which is privacy focused, they are a roll up. And so one difficulty with a roll up is that you inherit all the security risks of the L1, the Ethereum, right? They're sort of a layer built on top of that sends transactions down into Ethereum. So you inherit all the security risks of Ethereum, which at the current time seem low. I'm sure there are vulnerabilities that will be patched, but at least it's stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. Plus, you inherit all of the L2 vulnerabilities. So they're building their own essentially blockchain system on top of Ethereum, right? And so if you're going to transact within that layer, you have a lot of, you know, a wider array of like security attack vectors.
Yep.
So that's one thing that kind of goes against the L2 philosophy and something that feeds into Railgun's build out. We're building something that is layer one native. So it was very difficult to actually build it to be instrumented within that system. As I said, you know, building privacy as an afterthought is very difficult. Well, this, you know, privacy isn't built into Ethereum natively. And Railgun sort of engineered it to be native on Ethereum. Very okay. difficult to pull that off. And it's taken a long time to get to this point, but it is native on those chains. So you don't have the security vulnerabilities that go all the way up into an L2. Now, L2s are meant to be fast. Well, relatively fast. They're meant to be very cheap, right? You know, they're meant to be, I guess, medium speed, and it depends on sort of the implementation details. Ethereum natively is going to be the fastest. Things essentially get bundled. You can imagine an L2 like stacking 100 transactions and then submitting them all as a batch.
Yep. And then the L1 verifies that batch of transactions, and then it gets verified on the L2.
Yeah, that's right. And so you only really pay Ethereum gas fees once for this batch. So it reduces, it sort of amortizes all the fees for each of those people in the batch so that they're all paying $1 instead of $100 for the total batch. Mm-hmm. And so the fees are much lower, but you might be in a situation where you have to wait for that batch to get filled up. And so on Aztec, for example, I think it's every 6 hours they have an automated like batch fulfillment. And so you could be waiting up to that time limit. In practice, you know, there are mechanisms in place, I think, to speed that process up. But in theory, it could be a longer waiting time than an L1 solution. There are trade-offs here. Railgun is a little bit expensive to use. Everything on Ethereum native is pretty expensive. If you're going to use the Polygon variant of Railgun, it's pretty cheap as Polygon is. But, you know, it's all these trade-offs depending on what, sort of institution level you're at.
And so it's basically just analyzing the trade-offs. So it's like, okay, am I going to use Aztec as a layer two because I want to roll up natively to Ethereum? And I feel that the roll-up security is better than that of like either bridging to Polygon or bridging to Binance Smart Chain. So yeah. It's just like as someone, and this is more relative to like Ethereum native people, you just have to analyze the trade-offs of the various things that, you know, that are happening.
Yeah, exactly. And so like you have to think like, I don't believe it'll be zero sum in the future. Yeah. I don't see that, like, you know, there'll be like one privacy solution to rule them all kind of thing, right? Mm. It's kind of like, you know, Walmart and Target and, you know, all sorts of different things, right? You have, you know, if you look at grocery stores, you know, list goes on, right? And so I think we'll have like, you know, maybe a duopoly where, you know, two, you know, reign supreme, and then there's a myriad of others perhaps. But, you know, fundamentally, when you look at like layer two type solutions, you have to get over the centralization risks associated with layer twos. And, you know, if like censorship and that kind of risk isn't really a big deal to you and you're willing to take that risk for the exchange of like having a less expensive transaction, then that certainly makes sense for you. If the converse is true and you're willing to pay a little bit more to have a transaction, you know, happen directly on the base layer in exchange for like the ultimate security of that base layer, then you're going to do that, right? And so I think that, you know, there'll be some things where people are, you know, maybe perhaps okay with, you know, using, you know, layer twos, but, you know, there'll be other circumstances where people, you know, just uncompromisingly so want to have that layer one security. And so they opt to, you know, use, you know, maybe Railgun or whatever other L1 type, you know, privacy solution is out there.
Okay. Awesome. I want to segue because I've thought of a question I think will be relevant for people trying to like visualize this. So you mentioned a little bit earlier about how Railgun works. mean, admittedly, it's a lot over my head. I think just kind of trusting for someone who's a non-technical user, a lot of privacy is kind of trusting the team and kind of like looking at their background of like production development, like trusting them to build smart privacy solutions. So from a visualization perspective, how does a Railgun transaction appear on a block explorer? So like, for example, on Zcash, if I'm looking at a Z2Z transaction, the balance is shielded, the amount that both parties own is shielded, their address is shielded. You can't see anything, but you can see that the transaction happened. Conversely with Ethereum, account balances are all there. You see how much each person has, you see the transaction, what amount was sent, et cetera, et cetera. And then turns into that long linkage of like looking at someone's financial history. How does Railgun, from a functional perspective, how does that appear and visualize on a block explorer?
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting to compare it with Zcash for folks that are Zcash natives. With Zcash, you actually get a little more information than a Railgun transaction. Yes and no. With Zcash, you know that somebody is transferring ZEC. And with Railgun, you don't know which token they may be transacting with. It could be any variety of ERC-20 token. Of course, you could send a valueless ZEC transaction with just a memo, for example. But you do know ZEC is sort of the base token.
Because the fee is paying for the memo.
Yeah, and on Railgun, the only additional information you would get, you don't have the receiver address, you don't have the sender address. You don't have the token amount. It could be token amounts. It could be multiple tokens. You don't know which token was sent. Everything is essentially encrypted. The one thing you might be able to analyze is the amount of gas that was used to facilitate the transaction. Because at the end of the day, a certain gas amount, a million gas, might designate, a single token was transferred. We don't know which token or something. Maybe 2 million gas looks more like a swap or looks like a certain type of contract interaction. Again, you don't really know. These are things, though, that you could use to build a story, build a narrative, which, again, in a privacy-centric ecosystem, you don't want to allow anyone to really build narratives about your transaction history. So those are kind of the differentiators there. Maybe we can share along with the podcast, we can share a link to a Railgun transaction so folks can poke around.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I'll drop one in your DMs and you can put it in the show notes. And, you know, what you'll see in that particular transaction, it looks like it was a success, which is great. The from address is obfuscated by way of what's known as a relayer, right? So the person, paying for the computation associated with this transaction is not the actual sender or the initiator of the transaction, I should say. It's a relayer, which was built by the team to take and hide exactly that. But then the two addresses
are
really
interesting. It's like a false address. A relayer is like a false address.
Yeah, exactly right. It's basically, you know, there's somebody else out there who is, signing transactions on behalf of other users, right? And the reason why is on a public ledger chain like this, you know, someone has to pay the gas, very similar to, Zcash. There's a computation cost associated with doing a transaction. And so what happens here instead is a relayer pays the gas for the ultimate, purveyor of whatever this transaction was. Then the two address is the Railgun smart contract. And you can see here that the value displayed here is $0. And that's because you just don't know what it was that was being sent, right? You don't know if it was $1 million or two, right? You have no way to tell. And if you click more, you could see how much gas was spent, but all of the input data is just a bunch of garbly goop that no one can actually effectively decode. And so that in the show notes will be a wholly private transaction by way of Railgun on a public ledger blockchain.
Okay. And then from that perspective, so just to kind of like overview this, as we're like, I'd say like halfway through, quarters way through the show so far, Railgun is a system that has implemented ZK snarks within an Ethereum smart contract that privatizes transactions and funds. So you have you can shift and shield account balances into a zero ZK address that privatizes all the transactions and all of the different things you're doing associated with that address. When you run an address, you are running the transaction within that smart contract, but to make that transaction happen on the public ledger, which is Ethereum, you send that transaction to the transaction to a relayer that then will it do multiple transactions? Will it do just one transaction? How is the relayer determined? Like, is it just automatically, like, is it an algorithm? Is it someone choosing to be one? Is it like the system giving people funds? Like, what, how do you become a relayer? What is, like,
those are great questions. Yeah. So a relayer, at the end of the day, they're running a server from open source code that the Railgun team has published. And so if you want to be a relayer, Ian, you would essentially download this code. You would run a command and it would spin up a server and start relaying transactions with your wallet.
So it's kind of like a node.
It's like a node. Yeah. And okay. So you can set up different settings on it. So you could say the different tokens that you want to accept as a fee. You're going to pay at the end of the day in Ethereum for gas, right? Mm-hmm. But you might want to accept wrapped ETH that pegs pretty closely to ETH, right? You might want to accept DAI or USDC or some other tokens when you process these transactions. And your relayer is going to automatically figure out what the token prices are, automatically calculate a little bit of profit margin for you, and that's configurable. And it broadcasts these fees out. So it's just sending out to the network. It's sending, hey, if you want to pay with DAI, the price to ETH is what, $1,600? All right, we're going to add a little bit, $1,650 per ETH if you want to pay in DAI, right? And you're just broadcasting that out via your relayer.
Okay.
So the Railway wallet, for example, uses some of the relayer client tech that the Railgun team has built on the other end, right? It captures all these fees from different relayers and it figures out, hey, if I want to pay in DAI, Ian is actually the cheapest right now. He's $1,650, Alan's $1,680, this other relayer is $1,700, right? We're going to choose the lowest fee, and that's automated underneath. And so when you go to submit and pay in DAI, essentially what the Railway wallet will do is it will calculate what is the estimate for the gas costs in ETH. It will translate that to the fee payment that it needs to pay, right, Ian, for your relaying services, and it will package that into the transaction. So the first, essentially the header of the transaction pays you a fee, and the rest of the transaction does whatever else I want it to do, right?
Okay, that makes sense.
That transaction, when I send that transaction from my wallet over to yours, it is encrypted. It includes a snark proof in that transaction. You will only be able to read a small piece of it because of the way the proofs are generated, because of the way that transaction is encrypted. You'll be able to read that header that says, hey, you're getting a fee, you're getting $30 of DAI or whatever to submit this $25 transaction. That's great. You're like, oh, perfect, I'll just send it on, right? The rest of the transaction you can't decrypt at all. So as a relayer, essentially you can only read the note that's assigned to you, and the rest of the transaction, whether it's a swap or an unshield or a transfer or any number of DeFi activities, you won't be able to read what that person is doing, but you pass it on to the blockchain because you know you're getting a fee.
Okay. And so I feel like I'm going way too deep on this, but from a trust perspective, it's kind of like, let's compare this, right? So if you're running more familiar, I've been listening to a lot of Bitcoin podcasts recently. I don't know why, but like with Bitcoin and with any other, I guess, system, when you're running a transaction, if you're not running a node, you are trusting another node to verify the transactions, right? So there is a trust element when you're not running your own node. You're self-custodying your funds and, you know, whatever, but if you're not running your own node, there's like this trust vector. So with this, there is somewhat of this trust element that these relayers are going to submit the transactions. So my question, and that's not necessarily bad. I think that's just how most people are going to use. I don't think everyone in the world is going to run a node. So I think like most people are going to rely on different nodes and different systems to verify transactions. So my question is, can a relayer block certain transactions? Do they know the 0ZK address? That's, you said you can only see that you're getting a fee. So I'm asking, is there any way for relayers to block transactions of people they just might not like, or they might be pressured to block or whatever? Is there any chance of that?
So a relayer cannot see who is sending the transaction at all. They can't see the 0ZK address. They can't see their RIP address. We use a system called Waku, developed by the engineers at Status IM, to essentially, similar to onion routing on Tor, where essentially your message to the relayer hops along a few different nodes before it hits the actual relayer it was intended for. And so all along that way, and it's encrypted with the relayer's key, meaning that they're the only one that can actually decrypt it. No one else along the network will be able to. But since it hops along these nodes, the relayer would have a really hard time knowing its origin, right? Knowing where it came from.
Okay.
They can't know the IP address of the origin. And so they don't know your location. They really only know the time of day that you sent it, because it's almost immediate. And so based on that information, like, do you want to block transactions? I think as long as the relayers know they're right. getting paid, they basically are incentivized to send them on.
And it's really hard right. to block them anyways. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. Sorry.
I think too, what's worth noting here is that if the if like the relayer tried to manipulate the transaction in any way, let's say they wanted to like maybe steal the funds or send them somewhere else or do something nefarious, they'd be effectively trying to manipulate a SNARK proof that has been generated by you, the client, your private keys. And so if they tried to take and manipulate that SNARK proof, it would come back as an invalid SNARK, right? And so the transaction would revert. And it's actually, there'd be a penalty associated with this, because they would actually have to pay the gas to try to submit this this fraudulent proof, right? And so in that way, this system is really trustless and actually punitive to anybody who's trying to be nefarious. And I think secondly, you know, you could maybe think about another risk vector. Like, what if you generated this SNARK proof and the real JMJ relayer was the cheapest one, right? And he gets a hold of this transaction and he just refuses to submit it. You know, he's just like, I'm not going to submit it. You could just resubmit a transaction with the same knots, and it'll go through a different relayer. So you can actually just choose to use a different relayer. But let's just go like full nuclear, right? And let's just say that like the entire, for some reason, the relayer ecosystem just dies, right? And it's unrecoverable. If we go like completely nuts, it doesn't mean that your funds aren't, you know, safe or something like this. They wouldn't be at risk. You could just take and, you know, remove them from Railgun. So like even at like the highest, you know, most severe option, like the worst thing you have is like, you know, doxing an address to take and pay the gas to do some sort of transaction. And so it's to me, I think like the trust assumptions that you make with relayers are really, really quite low.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. And I think there's always going to be, I think this idea of trustlessness, I don't think trustlessness is binary. Like, I don't think decentralization is binary. I don't think privacy is binary. Mm-hmm. So I think this idea of trustlessness is like, are we achieving the maximum amount of trustlessness that we are possibly capable within a certain system? And mm-hmm. yeah. Okay, cool. Awesome. I want to shift again, because I did see a couple of questions. So I want to ask a couple more questions before we part ways today. The first of those is the tokenomics behind the Rail token. So a lot of tokens have certain properties about them that would enable value appreciation. And some tokens don't. Some tokens don't have great tokenomics, or they're within a good system that has a good application, but the tokenomics don't necessarily reward the people who are staking and holding the token. So with the Rail token itself, what is at a very high level, like the general tokenomics, and what's the reward for being a staker?
Man, it's so funny. We were just talking about this today on our like Discord. We call it like a weekly DAO download. And we actually have a new governance proposal that's about to drop pretty soon here, where it will take and reward people who stake the governance token Rail for their participation in governance. So in other words, if you're staking the token, you'll get a yield from the Railgun treasury. And so what's really cool about that is the treasury has a whole like magnitude of tokens, but primarily it's in what, DAI, Rail, and then wrapped ETH, I think, is in the treasury. And it'll actually pay out like the natural assets in the treasury. So it'll be a really attractive yield when it comes. But primarily the purpose of the Rail token is to take and deal with the needs of the DAO, whether that be the initial deployment of the Railgun smart contract, which was done by way of governance vote. In other words, there was some contract logic that was submitted to the DAO, and we, as a plebiscite, voted whether or not that would be deployed. And we made big jokes about it last year that maybe the competition would buy up a lot of tokens and vote no, and there would be no Railgun, but that didn't happen. Everybody, you know, we got a good yes vote, you know, resounding thumbs up from the community. And so they control the contracts associated with the privacy system. So if there's ever any sort of like upgrades or changes to the system that need to happen, they'll vote yes or no to that. They control the treasury funds, which currently are, I guess, right at $8 million in there at this exact moment. And so they can take and, you know, choose to pay grants to developers, you know, pay for marketing, I don't know, send it to the moon, whatever it may be, maybe buy a football stadium like FTX if we get rich enough. And we will, always let the DAO decide. And so primarily it's a governance token, but there will be, I think, some very interesting and appealing active governors rewards that should drop, you know, sometime towards the end of the year, which will be really exciting for everybody who's been participating thus far in the DAO.
Yeah, and to this point as well, active governors that are staking the Rail token have also gotten a few airdrops of an NFT drop that's going to be, I think, minted in a couple months time frame, as well as governance tokens for each of the various blockchains that Railgun privacy system is being launched on. So for example, on Binance and on Polygon and Solana and Near, there are Rail governance tokens that will be able to govern essentially like the small details, like sort of the settings. What are the fees on each different blockchain, depending on sort of the economics of using that blockchain and privacy. That can be governed independently through Rail BSC, Rail Poly, Rail Near tokens that were airdropped to Rail ETH stakers.
And can people stake Rail? Can they do that within a private 0ZK address, or do they have to use a public Ethereum address?
Not at the moment. Staking is through public address. But we will have mechanisms for private staking built into the Railgun contract in the short term.
Yeah, I would imagine that's actually really hard to do because you have to like verify, because governance is typically a public thing. So I think that work would seem really interesting.
It would need a special ADAPT module. The way that ADAPT modules work for cross-contract calls, calling to, you know, other contracts from your private balance, it passes through an intermediary, which we call the Relay ADAPT contract. And if that contract were to stake on your behalf, it would own the stake, right, for everybody. And since it's sort of an intermediary entity, it doesn't really work for those sort of back and forths. So there is a mechanism to enable that kind of behavior for rail staking. I think that'll be a little bit of a longer term build out.
Cool. Yeah, and obviously, governance token, there's a DAO. The last question I do want to ask specifically on Railgun is, tell us more about like the Railgun community and what it's like to be a member of the Railgun community.
Oh, man. It's, so we have the Church of Railgun. So first and foremost, it's very kind of blasphemous in nature. And I am a Railaluya churchgoer. It's a good, fun community. I would say it's really interesting to deal with these kind of communities, right? And, you know, we're just talking about it again on the DAO call today, right? We're very fortunate to have the community that we have because a lot of them are, you know, very pragmatic long-term players and see, like, the long-term vision that we're working for, which is to, you know, build infrastructure for privacy on public ledger blockchains. So what we're doing is massively complicated. And it's definitely, I'm sure we'll all agree here, needed in the space. And so a lot of the people who are like our biggest cheerleaders, you know, in our Telegrams, you know, Discord, shouting at us out on Twitter, you know, those people are really, really passionate about what we're doing. And so I'd say that they're a very friendly bunch as well. The memes are pretty good. I think somebody thought I was like what is it called? Like a rendered character. What is it? Like a fake picture or something? Apparently,
deep fake. Deep fake.
Yeah, deep exactly. Thanks. So, yeah, everybody thought I was a deep fake. I'm real. Thank you so much. The shout out to whoever made that like fettuccine owl picture. That was really funny. So, yeah, I'd say that everybody's really great, man. And you know, one of the things that we're going to be doing here, which I'm really excited about on our journey of like, call it progressive decentralization, is, you know, we're going to be looking and turning out to the DAO for, you know, assistance, you know, doing things and building, whether it be, you know, currently we're looking for someone with like Rust experience. And, you know, if those people come out of the DAO, that would be amazing. But beyond that, even if you're not technical, you know, we're going to start looking to put out bounties for, you know, various ways for people to get involved, whether it be write articles or develop videos or how to's, this kind of thing. And so everybody can, you know, be on the lookout for a, you know, maybe a D work or something like that. We'll put up a bounty board for people to go in, build for us as a community and help us, you know, grow the narrative together. And so not only will it be, I guess, rewarding from a comedy sense as everyone takes the piss out of me, it might be rewarding, you know, financially for people to take and, you know, participate in the DAO.
Awesome. Awesome. John, is there anything you want to add to that?
No, I you know, the DAO pushes us to move very fast and be our best selves. Definitely puts the pressure on, but we really like our community calls and love having the feedback from all the community members because we can't do this alone. So it really is a communal effort.
Awesome. Well, last question I've got for you guys. Before I turn it on you and see if there's anything I didn't ask you. What does crypto or privacy within cryptocurrency specifically, what does it look like in 5, 10 years, short-term future? Are we going to have, are we going to have better user experience? Or are people generally going to be adopting these things? Or are people going to continue to adopt the more transparent applications that are currently being widely used?
I think DeFi in general is going to be a gradual increase, crypto usage in general. I think you're right that, current user experiences are, I mean, for lack of a better word, abrasive to people that are not familiar with them. Right. They feel insecure. I remember sending my first ERC-20 transfer to an address and just pressing submit and hoping for the best. Right.
Yeah, sending it off into the ether, right?
There's no undo button. You can't talk to somebody on the phone. And so a lot of these systems that people are used to dealing with through a centralized entity, through a bank, they don't have a lot of the protections, right? They're not FDIC insured on their balances. If you put a wrong character at the end of the address you're sending to, good luck.
It's gone.
You know? Yeah. It's gone.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Unless if it doesn't, if it goes through, if like you mistype the address, it's, you either send it to a wrong person or it's gone.
Yeah, yeah. It won't be recoverable. And so, yeah, so I think these things will start to get better. And I think we're doing our best to contribute in that way. I think creating, SDKs that are easy to use for developers to build tools that make experiences better overall, right, is contributing to the system. Open sourcing a lot of our code, again, as we talked about, is a way to benefit many teams and not just our own. And we all sort of build together and stand on the shoulders of giants. I do think, I mean, when we look at the timeline, you know, when Ethereum is less than 10 years launched, when we talk about what things will look like in 10 years, it's probably pretty difficult to say. I think we're focused a little more on like what things will look like in 3 to 5 years. And we do think privacy is going to be a bit, more on the forefront of what people are doing and what people are thinking about. I think we draw the analogy a lot to the app Signal, which is for encrypted communications, and the fact that Signal came out and was out for a couple years before it kind of got like a lot of fanfare. But yeah. when the public image came out and people started realizing what the alternative was, the existing alternative, which was unencrypted communications, you soon saw WhatsApp and Instagram and some of the cloud communications tools people are using on a regular basis start to encrypt end to end, right? It became the standard. Of course, cloud communications for these big companies, I mean, they probably had to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to like transform those systems, but they had that money allocated. I do think privacy on blockchain is a little bit of a harder nut to crack, and that the first mover advantage in this space, if it does turn out like Signal, is going to have preferential treatment to the folks that were native in the beginning and thinking about this early in these, call it early privacy days for blockchains.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree with all of that. And I would add that, like, are you guys familiar with like GeoCities? Does that ring a bell for anybody here? So if it doesn't ring a bell for you, I'll tell you, GeoCities is like how people used to build like websites way back in the day. And they're like these very like rudimentary, like, no, not rudimentary, shitty websites. They're really bad, right? Everybody built these really bad websites by themselves. And they're absolutely abysmal and like they look like crap. I hope I never stumble upon the ones that I've made ever again. And that's where we are in crypto today, in my opinion, in DeFi today. And, you know, we have a long way to go until we're in the world of like Oculus, if you will. And I think that like the things that we're building today will ultimately become like the infrastructure of the future of DeFi, right? I think it'll be wholly different in 5 years, let alone 10. I mean, I think it's going to be absolutely insane. At the rate that we're speed running today, I think that we'll definitely have like a totally different landscape. And, you know, I think that we've had a lot of questions very recently. If you're listening to this, you know, recording in, you know, sometime in August, September, wherever it is in 2022, right? You know, we've had some really interesting questions asked about privacy and open source code in general, right? You know, the U.S. Treasury sanctions, I think we'd have to have a whole another podcast in order to sit and talk about those. But, you know, suffice it to say, you know, there's been a lot of regulatory headwind associated with privacy and, you know, open source code in general and crypto, very, very broad implications being made by very wide brush by these regulators. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that we'll see in the future is a lot more consideration for how to, you know, handle that. And I think, you know, perhaps this is like that initial spark that, you know, back in, if I equivocate it to something, maybe in like the early 90s, where we saw like the crypto wars take off and the battle for strong encryption for, you know, the regular citizens of the world took off. Maybe this is that point for us, and we can see this as an inflection point for us to really fight for what our civil liberties mean. Not to, you know, get on some sort of like political soapbox, so I'll kind of back off of that. But suffice it to say, I think that we'll, you know, we'll definitely have our own, you know, crypto wars for, you know, cryptocurrency. And I think it's really, really important that, you know, if we want the vision, the utopia of the future, if DeFi is going to be the future of crypto and we're going to go after, you know, the Swift ecosystem, or maybe, you know, the Visas, MasterCards, and, you know, American Expresses of the world, like we're going to have to really voice our opinions very strongly in order to realize that in that, you know, that 5 to 10 year time frame.
I would say also too, I'll just attack on the end of that. I think there's a lot of like really strong ideals in the crypto space. I think it was born out of strong ideals. And privacy is certainly one of them, decentralization. But those are going to, in the next, I think soon, we've started to see the beginning of that, going to conflict with the realities that are the current institutions, right? And so we've seen some of the sanctions come, right? Because, and I think, well, really, as it you know, ties to what we're doing, I think building our tools with ideals in mind is great, and having them completely private and completely secure, right, is absolutely fundamental. But also building them not only for the consumers and for the funds and for the people transacting, but also building it with auditors in mind and building it with these tools in place, so that people are still in charge of their keys, they're still in charge of their crypto, they're still, you know, able to transact on their own, in their own decentralized way, trustlessly, but they're able to share at least an impression of what they were transacting or when with a CPA, an accountant, with a tax attorney, with a government entity, if whatever the case may be, if they so choose to, right? Giving the power back to the people where it's private by default, but public scoped publicly, not public, but scoped for a certain individual, if you want, in order to, you know, tie that ideal, future that we all want to the pragmatic and realistic current place we are in, yeah, in history and society, right? Tying those together in some way. And that, I think, is a big learning opportunity, you know, that we've had very recently with the sanctions, and something that we're thinking about very closely.
Awesome. Great. And then, no, I would completely agree with that. I lean more towards the anarchist side than most people. So I would agree with, from like a fundamental, like, let's make this work in like this current ecosystem, like how those things can be useful. You know, like when Zcash, like viewing keys and different things like that for private transactions. I don't know. In practice, it does sound very, you know, reasonable, but within like a theoretical, more like utopian society, I would say like, get rid of it. But that is for like a completely other conversation, and obviously not like my scope of expertise. As we wrap up here, guys, where can people follow you?
They can definitely catch us on Twitter. We're not too hard to find. We're actually, I think both of us have been retweeted by the main account, so I would just go there. Follow, you know, Railgun Project on Twitter, and you could definitely catch us in the Telegram group, which is really great. And if you are a staker, you can come into the Discord and join our weekly calls and things like that as well. But yeah, public facing for sure. The Church of Railgun on Telegram, and then the Railgun Project on Twitter.
Awesome, great. Well, guys, thank you so much for your time today, and it was a blast. I had a ton of fun. Super informative. We went way deeper than I thought we would. It was cool to like beginners, and then we were talking about relayers at like a very, like, you know, I would say moderately technical level, even though probably not. But for me, it was very technical. So
no doubt.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for the time today. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.